Blog Talk Radio.
Mama.
Episode edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and once again, we have a power-packed show on our hands tonight. We have our featured guest tonight will be none other than street poet, activist, and journalist, Monte Smith. And if you've never heard the powerful street poetry and spoken word by Brother Monte Smith, hailing from North Carolina, you're in for a treat. I mean, he doesn't mince his words in any shape, form, or fashion, doesn't bite his tongue. He speaks it with true clarity, you know, and uses, you know, that platform that comes through his gift of being a spoken word artist. He uses that gift responsibly to disseminate information through his spoken word. whether folks are able to handle it or not. But he speaks with a clarity that the corporate media does not speak to on certain issues such as the prison industrial complex, white supremacy, police brutality, and so on and so on. So we'll be featured with him. We're going to talk about his latest book, Don't Shoot the Hostages. We're going to hear some of his work, and we're going to rap about a number of things. And so he'll be joining us for about 45 minutes, about right around 15 minutes into this program until the end of the hour. He'll be joining us. But first and foremost, I want to wish the listeners of Your World News, everyone that's listening right now, a happy and joyous holiday season with their loved ones. Regardless of what holiday you may be celebrating, I know that everyone has different religious affiliations and beliefs and mores and things of that nature. And so whatever, you use certain holiday or days off in terms of spending time with your family, hopefully you have a joyous holiday season. And while we're on the topic, we're on the eve of Thanksgiving, and sometimes I like to refer to it as Thanksgiving Day. If you're using Thanksgiving as an opportunity to spend time with your family and your loved ones and to really think about, giving back and those types of things, I think that that's a very appropriate way of using that holiday. But I also think it's also appropriate to think about the scores of indigenous people, Native Americans, Wampanoag, Pequot, Musquamicid Indians, whose lives were slaughtered by the murderous campaign of white European pilgrims and so-called settlers that came from Europe and just did massive destruction. If folks, please do not use Thanksgiving as an opportunity to celebrate the pilgrims. It should not be used as the pilgrims were evil and vile group of people, not all, but very many, and especially their leadership, such as folks like William Bradford, because we know that there were some pilgrims that took up arms and fought against the white supremacists, the racists, the evil, vile characters that, waged wars against, King Philip, the indigenous warrior who was fighting on behalf of his people. And, we know that there are certain folks that took up arms and fought, against those evil pilgrims. But by and large, please do not use this day to celebrate the pilgrims. Please do not use this day because it is, a vile, vile holiday to celebrate those folks. They were barbarians. They were animalistic. And what's so funny is that they're known as the civilized ones, the ones that are there to civilize the brown and black and red people of the world, But the root word of civilization is civil, and they were nothing remotely associated with what we, most of us, would call civil and civilized. And so they were barbarians, they were animals that needed to be put into a zoo. On display, that is exactly what they were. They wreaked havoc, in what's known as Massachusetts, parts of Connecticut, and they were met with kindness and just kind of like a very welcoming, how should I put it? They're welcomed by the indigenous folks. They're welcomed, and they're welcomed with kindness. They were taught, in places like Maine and what's known as New Hampshire, they were taught which berries were poisonous, which ones they could eat. They were taught how to keep themselves warm in the wintertime. They were taught by the indigenous folks, the Native Americans. And how do they repay them? They repay them, through murderous campaigns, such as the one that Thanksgiving holiday is based on. They decapitated, they burned women and children at the stake. They kicked their heads down, they kicked their heads down dirt pathways. They cut when they murdered folks like King Philip, they cut his head off. And they cut his head off and they put it on a stake. And they put many indigenous people's heads on stakes to remind, you know, to remind them that this is what happens. This is what happens if you have the audacity to fight back and to defend your land and remind their people that you know, in front of kids. And so the kids were indoctrinated. Their children were indoctrinated with the vile hatred that their parents brought with them, you know, from Europe. And, you know, and as we know, the pattern continued on. The pattern of white supremacy and hatred continued on. So, you know, that's my bit on Thanksgiving. Sorry to be a downer for some folks, but you need to take the blue pill. And by all means, if it means that you take the blue pill and Thanksgiving, you know, because I'd rather, you know, have light shed on something and for me to know exactly the roots of various holidays and information, even if it's a little bit of a downer, I'd rather know rather than continue to be a zombie the rest of my life and, you know that I'm worshiping something that is amoral. So anyways, with that being said, I want to do a couple news clips. And as you all know, you know, I get many of my news clips from Black Agenda Report and Brother Glenn Ford. If you have never heard of Black Agenda Report, I really encourage you to go to www.blackagendareport.com. It's a great place where you can get hard-hitting analysis, because if you're looking to the corporate media to get critical analysis about current issues and stories that are nationally centered, locally, or even globally, that's not the place you want to get critical analysis of those issues. You need to look to the alternative media. So anyways, let me play you a couple of clips from Black Agenda Report, and then when we come back, we'll be joined by Monty Smith, and we'll hit the ground running, and we'll have a 30-conversation about a number of things. So here is Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report talking about Afghanistan.
If you're looking for the chief kingpin in the Afghanistan heroin trade, it's the United States. The American mission has devolved to a mafiosa-style arrangement that poisons every military and political alliance entered into by the U.S. and its puppet government in Kabul. It is a gangster occupation in which U.S.-allied drug dealers are put in charge of the police and the border patrol, while their rivals are placed on American hit lists marked for death or capture. As a result, Afghanistan has been transformed into an opium plantation that supplies 90% of the world's heroin. An article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine explores the inner workings of the drug-infested U.S. occupation, its near-total dependence on alliances forged with players in the heroin trade. The story centers on the town of Spin Baldak, on the southeastern border with Pakistan, gateway to the opium fields of Kandahar and Helmand provinces. The chief Afghan drug lord is also the head of the border patrol and the local militia. The author is an undercover U.S.-based journalist who was befriended by the drug lord's top operatives and met with the U.S. and Canadian officers that collaborate with the drug dealer on a daily basis. The alliance was forged by the American forces during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 and has endured and grown ever since. The drug lord, and others like him throughout the country, is not only immune to serious American interference, he has been empowered through U.S. money and arms to consolidate his drug business at the expense of drug-dealing rivals in other tribes, forcing some of them into alliance with the Taliban. On the ground in Pashtun-speaking Afghanistan, the war is largely between armies run by heroin merchants, some aligned with the Americans, others with the Taliban. The Taliban appear to be gaining the upper hand in this mafiosa gang war, the origins of which are directly rooted in U.S. policy. Is it any wonder, then, that the United States so often launches airstrikes against civilian wedding parties, wiping out the greater part of bride and groom's extended families? America's drug-dealing allies have been dropping dimes on rival clans and tribes, using the Americans as high-tech muscle in their deadly feuds. Now the Americans and their European occupation partners have institutionalized the rules of gangster warfare, with official hit lists of drug dealers to be killed or captured on site, lists drawn up by other drug lords affiliated with the occupation forces. This is the war of necessity that President Barack Obama has embraced as his own. It is a war whose order of battle is largely defined by the drug trade. Obama's generals call for tens of thousands of new U.S. troops in hopes of lessening their dependency on the militias and police forces currently controlled by American-allied drug dealers. But of course, that will only push America's Afghan partners in the drug trade into the arms of the Taliban, who will cut a better deal. Then the generals will argue that they need even more U.S. troops. The Americans created this drug-saturated hell, and their occupation is now doomed by it. Unfortunately, they have also doomed millions of Afghans in the process. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Thank you so much for tuning into that. And as I said before, it's imperative that we don't look to the corporate media to get critical analysis about these critical issues, these geopolitical issues that dominate so many different things in our day-to-day lives. You know, one of the things that we often never discuss is the fact that, you know, we in this whole debate about healthcare and where the money is going to be coming from, the corporate media will never bring into the fray, will never bring into the discussion the fact that this country continues to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. Like, for instance, this year, under the Obama administration, you know, we're set to spend $680 billion this upcoming fiscal year, and that doesn't even include the money that's been appropriated by Congress to fight these wars of aggression and imperialism in Iraq and Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan. And so those are your dollars. If the U.S. was even to scale back 25% of its military expenditure, we would have more than enough money to provide universal free health care for every individual in this country that does not have health care. It is a human right. So these are things that we need to really bring into the discussion and not let the corporate media and the corporate government, you know, the very much fascist government that we're living under, dictate what the issues are and how we understand these issues. And so without further ado, I'm going to introduce Brother Monty Smith in one moment. And for instance, when we talk about critical analysis, this is a brother who was able to paint a very vivid picture about a number of politically driven topics and issues through his spoken word. He's a journalist as well. I've often said that journalists are among, especially good journalists, are the ones that know the issues far better than so many folks that we turn to on the corporate media. Those folks are just kind of like talking heads. And so I want to introduce Monty Smith by playing one of his spoken word pieces. And then as soon as that's over, we're going to jump right into a conversation with him, and perhaps he'll shed some light in terms of what precipitated him to write this piece, because I think it's a most powerful piece. So without further ado, this is Monty Smith, and as soon as this piece is done, we're going to hit the ground running.
It's funny. Every time I'm interviewed, I'm always asked, what makes you write the way you do? Well, I write like I do because John Brown inspired me to, because I'm an abolitionist, because of the no-fly list, because of unjust taxes, because the pigs are still using poor people as target practice, because 9/11 was an inside job, because the School of Americas is still open, therefore Latin America is still open to rob, because the majority of blacks in this penal colony still follow the master's religion, because we're killing ourselves over simple traditions, because James Byrd has been forgotten, because greed is starving our souls, because Babylon is so rotten, because Brandon McClellan's story hasn't been told. I write like I do because the Move 9 needs me to. because you may be thinking change, but Obama won't free Mumia because someone raped and killed Sister Rita, because AIDS is man-made, because the CEOs killed Brother Wade, because hate caved in Emmett Till's head, because most whites believe racism is dead, because there's a war against the youth and no one cares, because Curtis Mayfield died broke in a wheelchair, because the mark of the beast isn't 666, it's the cross around your neck, because rap music is under corporate check, because 160 private prisons are functioning in 26 states, because our sanity is at stake, because revolutionary music is under federal attack, because many of you haven't read the Patriot Act. I write like I do because Peter Tosh told me to, because Western civilization equals white domination, because manifest destiny has been replaced by globalization, because No Child Left Behind is a joke, because the 60s traded revolution for disco and coke, because resistance is all I taste, because what's popular ain't real, it's programming that kills like believing in religion, money, and race, because my brother committed suicide, because there's a digital divide, because Shaquanda Cotton has been forgotten, because Unicor is profiting off the poor, because Babylon is so rotten, because mentally, mama can't take it anymore. I write like I do, because very few are willing to, because it feels good not to fit in, because we need more sit-ins, mass rallies, and teach-ins, because riot police don't wear numbers or names on their uniforms, because the U.S. has signed over 400 treaties with the Indians and violated every one, because Bill Hicks is dead and gone, because when it comes to reparations, it's the same old song, because no one group can start the people's revolution, because solidarity is the only solution, because we live in a world where the darker you are, the more hunted you are, because I don't like religious nationalism, fascism is fascism, because the Coca-Cola and Banadex courts in Colombia are killing union leaders, because I love my daughter, but it's getting harder to feed her, because revolution is bloody, and most slaves aren't willing to face it. I write like I do because there's blood in this poetry, and I want you to taste it.
What did I tell you? What did I tell you? That's like the sixth time I heard that piece since it was bequeathed upon me by my brother Monty Smith about a week ago, and it just keeps getting better. So without further ado, Monty Smith, we're live on air. I'd like to just jump into it. If you can,
yes, sir.
Can open
yes,
up
thank
and.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. If you could tell the audience, you know, a little bit about yourself and what kind of things during the course of your life have inspired you to write like you do.
Oh wow. Let's see. My name is Monty Smith. I'm from North Carolina. I consider myself a street poet because I really don't have time for the Love Jones, King looking for Queen, Queen looking for King, Mountain and Flowers. I believe the times are too dire to continue the mass supporting of most poetry nights that reflect on teenage angst, boyfriend-girlfriend problems. Once again, I feel the times are too dire. There's too many children dying in the streets. There's too many children that are being brainwashed by corporate media, by the music at hand today. By the corporation boards that are pushing this music. I was an activist before I became a poet. Like I said, I'm from North Carolina, and in the late 80s and early 90s, I was involved with SHARP and ARA. SHARP is Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, and ARA is Anti-Racist Action. And what we were involved with were going to Klan rallies and breaking them up so they couldn't march. So therefore, you know, being a youth coming of age and, you know, and protest lines, directly taking the Klan head on because no one was, you know, stepping to them. You know, you would have people that would come and protest and hold signs, things of that nature, but nobody was bringing it to them. Nobody was really stepping out of bounds to say, look, you are not welcomed. And this will result in bloodshed. SHARP was a very militant group. ARA was a very militant group. We had over 500 people organized on the Eastern Seaboard, and we met at any and all rallies and cut my teeth, so to speak, you know, in the street fighting the Klan and also fighting the political powers and the cops that would basically let these marches happen, keep so many people at bay. We always felt and we always kind of knew that a lot of the police, or some of the police, I should say, that were working on the day of the Klan marches were also Klan members. If you look back to Greensboro, to the Morningside home shooting between the Communist Workers Party and the Ku Klux Klan, you know, that was a direct result of the police allowing that. Okay, so that is the environment that I come from. I would also like to make a quick note, since I brought up Sharp, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. Real skinheads are not white power. Real skinheads are a result of Jamaican and British youth coming together under reggae music and supporting a way of life and a style of life. So a lot of people, when you hear the word skinhead, you automatically assume it's white power, anti-Semitic. That is not the case. More people need to know our story and not his story. And the popular media definitely isn't going to tell you that. Bad news sells papers. Positivity doesn't.
Right, right.
So from the Klan marches, I just, you know, always had that spirit. And I had to figure out a way to be able to educate people, to let them know that, you know, a lot of people claim the South. I live in the South. They say it's the new South. It's not. The plantation is still open. You know, a lot of people in the South, a lot of white people in the South, they still, you know, have a lot of learning to do. And that is very important to address, especially since I am a white person. Only white people can end white supremacy. White people have to take racism by the collar and do something with it. Like I said, and let me repeat this again, only white people can end white supremacy. So instead of me trying to speak to the pulpit, you know, I try to go out and I try to direct my poetry now to people that really don't want to hear it. Once again, you can't always speak in front of the pulpit. You have to bring attention to what you're saying, especially if it's backed by truth and especially if it's backed by love. Because once again, I get the feeling from you, from your writings that I find are also incredible. It's about love. And that might sound cliche, but there is not enough love. You know, hate is what kills people. Love is what protects people. And more people have to understand that solidarity is the only way out of the problems that are facing us, whether it be economic, whether it be with our religious traditions, whether it be with the public education system. There is not enough solidarity amongst poor people, and that is what is killing us, or allowing the corporate takeover to eat poor people for profit. So from the Klan rallies, I've always stayed militant. I've always had that spirit. I've continued to write, and I try to address my writings to benefit people who will not speak out or can't speak out.
Thank you. It's interesting that you and thank you for the compliment about my writings. And you're right. It's I always like to think about a quote that Huey P. Newton once said. He said, to paraphrase him, I'm not driven by, you know, great hatred for other people. The reason I do what I do is because I'm driven by great love.
That's
for
right.
Other people. You know what I'm saying?
It's not cool to talk about love. Love is not hard. Due to the systematic conditioning of America, you know, there's such a testosterone, male macho-driven mentality and image, and that comes from 400 years of slavery. That comes from many, many, many things. But at the end of the day, we still, as men, carry this brutish, you know, mentality and complex. And that right there puts up, you know, blockers. You know, it's hard to connect and extend your hand if you're constantly fronting like you're hard. And people need to really address their own core of heart of hearts and realize, are you full of hatred? Are you a part of the problem? Or are you trying to expand love and try to expand social consciousness where it affects and benefits other poor people? Because let's think about it. You know, most people are poor. Most people have maxed out credit cards. Most people, or a lot of people, don't have credit cards. I mean, there is a big misconception that a lot of Americans are doing well and there is this middle class. There is no middle class. You either have it or you don't. Look at the job rate. Look at the job rate loss. I mean, it's skyrocketing still. And I'm not here bashing anybody's administration, but the facts are the facts. And as much as I want to deal in with love, I have to deal with facts. You know, at the end of the day, as a street poet, as a journalist, truth is what I'm after, and getting other people to understand and to see that, you know, there's a lot of lies, there's a lot of misconceptions that are being thrown at us every day, from Hollywood to television to radio to basic other people speaking to you at work or in the restaurant, because they're being misfed the wrong information. So love and truth is where it's at, as cliche as that sounds.
Definitely. I wanted to ask you about, how did you become, before we get into more of the poets, the spoken word stuff that you do, and even getting, you know, being able to sink our teeth into Don't Shoot the Hostages, how did you get into journalism? What drove you to get into to being a journalist?
Well, I am a product of what I would like to consider the greatest culture of expression ever, which is hip-hop music, hip-hop culture. You know, Spoonie G to DJ Flowers, Coco La Rock, Afrika Bambaataa, the early beginnings to the middles to, you know, the late 80s, where you had Public Enemy bringing awareness to, you know, that would evolve into Poor Righteous Teachers, X-Clan, Brand Nubian. This, you know, I grew up in that whole flow of music, and it was the teaching and education that I was not getting at school. And due to my background and family situation, I was in and out of school. And a lot of what I was missing at school, I was getting from Chuck D. I was getting from, you know, Wise Intelligence, from Poor Righteous Teachers. They were teaching me how to be a humanitarian. They were, you know, the school system barely teaches you how to survive. It doesn't teach you about racism in America. It doesn't teach you about understanding one another. Basically, it gives you a half-ass attempt to basically go out, get a job. You might be lucky enough to go to college, pass you through, blah, blah, blah. And it's even more that problem now with No Child Left Behind. But it's always been rap music. As Chuck D once said, rap music is the black CNN. But, I took it as, hey, I'm not getting this education and this truth and this side of the world anywhere else. And I grew up in a time where, you know, you had MTV, you've got all of the glam bands, you've got, you know, heavy metal dying out. There wasn't much music with message. And when I was young and from the Klan rallies protesting, hardcore music coming out of New York, which was a lot of what was, ARA and Sharp Music, was kind of dying out on its own, and there wasn't that message. So militant rap music took its place. So militant rap music has always been my second dad. Mm-hmm. And it always kind of guided me, and I've always felt that it guided me to become not a better white person in white-dominated society, but to become a humanitarian and to see past race and to see the issues of what people on this planet are facing and need. And that's what real rap music does. It teaches you how to be a humanitarian. And people have lost and forgot that due to the corporate takeover and due to people wanting to kill the art for checks. And that's what we have today is a bastardized Frankenstein-type mutation of something that once was the pillar of the community through expression and spreading valuable knowledge. Now it's become a 24-hour Texaco with a crack house in the back and a prostitute out front selling, you know, miscellaneous mind garbage to stray the youth to not read, to stray the youth not to look back at your past and history. And I also think there's a lot of blame due to us and our generation, because obviously we as the older brothers and sisters did not take the time or didn't take enough time to teach the younger brothers and sisters coming up, this is what's good, this is what's got message, this is what we really need to be on. But somehow we didn't get that message across to them, and so many other things came available to where you now hearing, you know, Lil Wayne is the best rapper on the planet. That's
right.
Sickening to me.
Yes.
That's sickening to me.
Yeah.
All right? Jay-Z is a pawn. Real rap music has been killed due to people such as Soulja Boy, Jay-Z, And I know people are out there thinking, what is this guy talking about? But the corporate influence has taken over so much to the point to anyone out there who saw the music awards the other night. You know, real rap music doesn't belong on television. Real hip-hop culture, it does not belong on TV. The TV is the enemy. But people are so used to coming home, getting a Taco Bell combo, getting in their Lazy Boy recliner, Lazy Boy satisfying themselves with a remote control, boom, they tune out. You know, and that's reinforcing that. The music of today is doing everything it can to dumb our children down, to steer them away from resistance, to steer them away from solidarity. They want white Michael fighting black Johnny. I mean, it is what it is.
Right, right. And you know, when I look at your book, you know, I totally agree with everything you said. I mean, I like the way you place that analogy, comparing it to making it analogous to Frankenstein. You know, this mutation, which is, you know, this mutation that has been created by corporate America, and they've created the cookie cutter shell, and they, you know, they seek those, you know, men and women who are willing to step inside that cookie cutter shell and do their bidding. And as you said, if you're a young brother or sister and you want to step outside that cookie cutter shell, and let's say it's the proverbial box, and you want to address, you know, white supremacy or police brutality or capitalism or those types of things head on in your music, there's no way that they're going to give you a platform. And so you're right, it doesn't belong on television, because television is a corporate beast, and there's no way that they're going to. It's counterintuitive for them to put artists like yourself and Chuck D and, you know what I'm saying, Mr. Lift and Acrobatic and you know, Jay Rawls and on their platform. And I was looking at your book, and I haven't gone through all of it, but I was reading, you know, because it's a book, I've seen a lot of powerful poetry in there, and there's a lot of social commentary.
Well,
and,
could I, you brought up something that I would like to bring up a point on as well.
Sure.
With the Frankenstein mutation, it's reversed the actual platform that belittled black people in the early 19th century, which is weird. If you look back, like Elvis Presley, Pat Boone, Led Zeppelin, the people who stole and robbed, you know, quality music from black musicians, only for them to get paid and to get notoriety and to go on and retire in big fat homes, while Big Mama Thornton, who sang Hound Dog, which was originally written by Otis Blackwell, you know, and Otis Blackwell wrote half of Elvis's first singles, but was forced by Colonel Tom Parker to make Otis give Elvis co-writing credits. Okay, so, you know, white people through music and through art have been robbing black people this, you know, the whole time. You know, I mean, it's sad to say that Little Richard quit recording at the height of his career because Pat Boone did a remake of Tutti Frutti.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it goes on and on and on, and now you've got, you know, the white corporate execs trying to make money off black artists in a new way, where it's stagnating growth and it's stagnating artistic integrity, and it just kills me that it's not being addressed. I mean, it still hasn't really and truly been addressed at all about what Led Zeppelin did. I mean, Willie Dixon, the writer of a lot of the Led Zeppelin songs that became famous, yeah, he walked away with $1 million settlement in court, but it was only after that $1 million lawsuit that Led Zeppelin even came out and credited the people they stole from.
Right.
You know? And they did it because they thought they, out of ego, had entitlement. And now that same, you know, passing of the buck, this corporate board of today is basically saying, here's a check, but you're only going to get this check if you dehumanize yourself and dehumanize your surroundings and dehumanize the people that you run and live with and share community with. And I think it's a slap in the face, and I think people need to wake up and address that.
Definitely, and you're one of those people that has been addressing that. And, you know, your latest book, Don't Shoot the Hostages, addresses it. I mean, I love the social commentary, you know, that as well as the social commentary that is within the the poetry that you have within there. If you can,
thank you.
Tell our listeners, you know, a little bit more about your book. What precipitated you to write this book? Because it is a collection. I mean, it's a must. I mean, folks, this is a must get book. If you're a lover of the hip hop that Monty Smith is talking about, if you're a lover of
revolutionary poetry,
The Last Poets, that kind of stuff, this is the book to get. So if you could talk about your book, what precipitated you to put it together, and also how can folks get a hold of this book?
Okay. Well, Don't Shoot the Hostages, it's more than just another conscious or radical poetry book. What I tried to do was bring clarification and understanding of race, white guilt, religion, police brutality, the real drug war, America the Plantation. And this is all coming from the perspective of the common man and woman. Like I said, back, you know, a lot of the poetry nights and, you know, it's not reality based. A lot of it's fantasy, a lot of it's whatever, and that's great. And there's many, many, many places for that, and that's fine. But there's not many places where poets such as myself, you know, can really go and not be criticized because, quote unquote, we're angry. You know, I hear that too much. But and what's surprising is that they're not angry. But that's a whole other story. But Don't Shoot the Hostages. It is there to clarify, you know, the prison industrial complex, international poverty issues from the perspective of the revolutionary, the drug dealer, the addict. The Forward was written by Bruce George, who is the creator of HBO's Death Poetry Jam. Carlos Andres Gomez contributed to the book. JD from the Lynch Mob contributed to the book. Nancy Winters, who is Mumia Abul Jamal's right-hand person when it comes to statistics and numbers. She's amazing. She collects. She has so much information, and she really is good friends with Mumia and has helped him with a lot of his writings. So she was kind enough to share some of her perspective of what she's seen through, you know, the prison industrial complex and how it's using the drug war to basically enslave a whole nother round of people for the new generation. If anybody's out there is familiar with the West Coast underground rap scene from the early 90s, Abstract Rude, who is still doing it today, but was, you know, legendary Project Blowed, Abstract Tribe Unique. He donated a piece, a very prolific and revolutionary MC from North Carolina who goes by the name of the Mad Rabbi. He donated a piece. So really, really revolutionary, loving, well-thought-out people also contributed to this book, and I just can't stress how important this book is for everyone that is looking for revolutionary poetry or conscious poetry or outspoken poetry and is tired of the run-of-the-mill daily, I'm not getting anything out of this anymore, you know, walk. I mean, it's a great book for anybody that's fans of Sam Greenlee, who was author of The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Yeah.
Sam Greenlee gave me a great quote here recently. He read Don't Shoot the Hostages, and he made the comment to me that, you know, he hasn't read revolutionary poetry like this in a long time, and it's because it doesn't make money. And that goes back to love and loving your fellow brother and sister, because there is no money really in what I'm doing. The book that I'm pushing right now, and I'm talking about Don't Shoot the Hostages, you know, I'm doing this. I'm putting this out myself, and I want to say thank you to all of the people that have bought the book. The book is doing well, but it needs to do better for me able to continue a second run and a third run. I mean, and trust me, people, this book isn't going to buy me a sports car. It's not going to get me a condo in Manhattan. It's going to put more books on more people's tables so young people can understand the society, the system of what they're facing and what they're living in.
Right. And so they can get it in on Amazon or a bookstore.
Oh, they can go to www.streetpoetmontysmith.com. The book is $12 for paperback, or you can order an ebook for $5. And once again, the money goes to putting more books on more tables to get out to more people such as yourself, so we can carry on more interviews, so we can bring up real topics, real things that are affecting poor people and people in the struggle and people aware and are conscious of a struggle.
Right. And I want to put it out there that, folks, this won't be the last time if I have one of my holiday wishes, this won't be the last time that I have Brother Monty Smith on. So, you know, because, it, you know, as you probably think, an hour is definitely not enough time to really delve into a lot of the work that Monty Smith has done. And also, you know, a good friend of mine, you know, referred me to Monty Smith, whose opinion I respect highly, and that was Capital X. And he said, man, you got to get this brother on your show. This brother Monty Smith, you know, it brings the fire. You really want
That's a compliment. That's a compliment from you and Capital X, because, hey, Capital X walked from Trenton, New Jersey, to Austin, Texas, to bring attention to the death penalty, and that's committed. That's what I'm talking about. People who are willing to get outside of their comfort zone, comfort box, and do something for the betterment of society, which is humanity, which is us. Stop, you know, put down your flags, put down your gods, put down your color. We're people, and we have needs, and we can find those needs if we come together in a common way. And there is a way to do this. This isn't just talking off the top of the head. There are ways that poor people can come together to better our lives. I mean, we wouldn't even have the free lunch program if it wasn't for the attempts of the Black Panthers. You know, that's the reason why we have the free lunch program in the United States today, which is astronomical numbers right now. I mean, it's almost like one or two out of every five kids is on free lunch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that is a direct result from the revolutionary work of people going against the system, going against the grain, and bringing real change in the neighborhood and starting in the neighborhood. You have to start at ground zero. That is right outside your front door.
Right. Definitely. Without a doubt. And since you know, we touched on Capital X and what he's done around the death penalty, that last piece that that we played, the piece that I used as a point of departure into this interview. Yeah, you mentioned the prison industrial complex. You mentioned the privatized prisons. You know, in your piece, how did you learn about the prison industrial complex and how did it impact you so much where you felt it was important that folks need to know about this all-important issue that most Americans have no idea about the term prison industrial complex?
Well, the prison industrial complex, to break it down, is just another way of saying profit sharing. And what really brought it to my attention is the mandatory sentencing, you know, for example, crack cocaine. 5 grams gets you 5 years without parole. You know, 50 grams gets you 10 years. But a little bit of cocaine, a great astronomical amount of cocaine would get you the same result. I mean, the drug laws, the Rockefeller laws, the sentencing laws, and anybody out there that's listening to me, definitely check out the Sentencing Project online. .com, the Sentencing Project has great numbers. They're always constantly updating the numbers of how many people are being incarcerated, or what crimes, blah, blah, blah. But the sentencing situation is really what brought my attention to wanting to see what the prison industrial complex was all about. For example, you know, what if there was, you know, lobbying going on for tougher sentencing so people would stay in prisons longer? Therefore, the people who are winning the bids and contracts for things that are needed within commissary, such as razors, cookies, chips, drinks, blah, 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 blah. You know, I mean, if you get a bid in the, you know, the private prison industrial complex, you're paid. You know, there's only going to be one razor bought, yours. So what if you are a corporation, what are you going to do? You're going to have people in D.C. lobbying for tougher sentencing and for laws that are quicker and easier to break, so people find themselves, you know, walking in and out a revolving door, you know. And that is what the whole prison system has become. It's become a revolving door. I mean, if your grandmother hasn't been arrested yet, watch out. Within the next year, she's got a good chance of being arrested. I mean, everybody is probably listening to me right now, has a friend, has a family member that is doing time, or knows somebody on their way, or knows somebody that's coming out. Why is that? Why do we lock up more people in America than any country in the world?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the United States still is the only country in the world that still has the death penalty. You know, I mean, too many people have fallen through the cracks, and too many innocent people have died at the hands of the state, and that means no one is safe. You know, for people who kill children, hurt children, I mean, people who are really just really on the wrong planet, you know, I don't have a problem with something being done to these people, but I don't want it done by the state because I don't want to find myself miscellaneous thrown around in some situation, and you know, and I'm booked for something wrong, you know, which, you know, which is a whole other story, and I could tell you about New Orleans and getting locked up for my poetry down there. So it is possible. It is possible. So the sentencing laws are totally, totally a red flag, and it should bring attention to everyone. Everyone, everyone's freedom is in danger when we have sentencing laws projected and set up the way they are. Now, the Rockefeller laws, through the work of a lot of activists in the last couple of years, has been broken down. But we're still seeing the results of children revolving in and out, little petty crimes, but getting larger time. There were some judges in Louisiana just in the last week that came under indictment for basically feeding a local private prison down there certain inmates for certain crimes, which would gain so many years, and for so many years that they were getting paid for it, that was kind of the kickback the prison staff or the prison board was kicking to the judges. You know, you can go and look that up on CNN.com. So I mean, it's something not to be trusted, and it's all about money. And that's the problem. It's not about justice. It's not about freedom. It's not about right or wrong. It is about profit. And when people become profit or walking barcodes, then no one is safe. And the prison industrial complex should be like the boogeyman. Tell your kids at night, you better watch out. The prison industrial complex is going to get you.
I like that. You're right. You're right. Definitely. Yeah.
You know, our jails and prisons are full of people, you know, who are poor and without stability and without ways of getting ahead, without education, without organization. Look at what's going on in Chicago with all of the children over the summer, on into September. The death rate that was going on there. There is not enough for the youth to be involved with on a positive note. There is too much negativity and destruction ready and willing and waiting to take them on, but there is not enough positive reinforcement coming through social organizations and through just basic people that live in neighborhoods where they know crime is a problem. They've got to come together. Instead of just going home and turning the TV on and drinking a beer, get out in your neighborhood and see what you can do to make it a better living situation, a better living condition for the youth. These are the people that will be taking care of us one day, as cliche as that is to say, but it's the truth. We have to see our youth as our keepers. We have to treat them more valuable. Therefore, we need to rearrange what we're doing with the public education system. It's dumbing our children down, and it's only creating more prison opportunities to happen.
Right. And how would you say that these things have factored into the erosion of the family structure? Because I remember that, you know, that was one of the things that I've heard you kind of mention in different pieces.
Well, you know, in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot more family structure, in the sense that, you know, you had the idea of, you know, working, and there was more jobs, but with Vietnam and with the military complex starting up and everything that happened, and it just showed itself for truly what America was, and it's eating poor people for profit. The family structure broke. The drugs became heavily much more on the scene. The government realized they could make a whole lot more money from drugs than war. So all of a sudden, the prisons started being built. More people were being put in. More laws were being thrown on the table for quicker and tougher sentencing. And basically, you know, the war on drugs is a war on poor people. And when the woman is at home trying to take care of the kids because the man is locked up or working two or three jobs, the children aren't getting the balance that they need. You know, it takes,
right.
it takes, as the saying goes, it takes a village to raise a child. That is true. The result of the violence that we're seeing, the result of the this lack of social interest that a lot of the youth have today is because they did not get the loving they should have at home, because too many young people are having children. In return, they didn't get what they needed, so how are they going to pass it down to their youth? So that's where people in the neighborhood, people that know better, we need to kind of put our arms around the people that can't reach out and let them know what needs to be done and show it in a way to where it benefits neighborhoods and benefits cities and benefits on and on and on and on and on. And the family structure is definitely broken due to the prison industrial complex, due to the military complex, due to the basic need that we cannot feed our families anymore. I cannot, as a man, go out here and feed my family working 40 hours. I've got to work 80 hours. And in the process, what is that doing to my health? What is that doing to my mental stability? How am I going to be a loving, reasonable person to come home and deal with my children when I don't have anything left because I just gave it away for $9 an hour?
Yeah.
At 80 hours a week and still not being able to catch up. And you know, and you look around and you're like, hey, man, this ain't right. I can't keep continuing to do this. So what do? You start making bad decisions. Next thing you know, you got a pound in your hand. You got this in your hand. You're trying to do this, and it went well one time, and the second time you're on your way back, and guess what? The blue lights come on, boom. Now, instead of providing for your children, you're trying to figure out money for your lawyer, and you're looking at 5 years.
Right. Man, yeah, you're right. That's a lot of food for thought. Before we leave, because we have about a couple minutes left, I wanted, and once again, listeners, this is not the last time Monty Smith, you know, if we're lucky, will not be the last time he's on this program. But Monty,
yeah,
I want to know.
We haven't even scratched the surface, so I'll be glad to come back.
Not even half of it. I wanted to ask if you could leave contact information in terms of how listeners can get a hold of the work that you've done. I know you have a website, and you know perhaps you have an email where folks can reach out. But also, and this is something I'm going to personally work on because I happen to be a college administrator. I'm going to be working on after this break, trying to get to secure some money to actually bring you to our campus where you can perform. But how can people get a hold of you if they want to try to book you for a performance at their organization or their school as well?
Sure. You can reach out to streetpoetmontysmith@gmail.com. That's my email address. For anybody that is interested in what I had to say, interested in my art, my poetry, please go to www.streetpoetmontysmith.com. I have videos of me performing at the Nurekin, an encore performance at Mangoes in D.C. There's videos that you can see. I have lots of music projects up. The website's bananas. There's lots and lots and lots of information. Please read my blog, all that good stuff. But once again, if you want to book Monty, bring me to your city. Reach out to me at streetpoetmontysmith@gmail.com. Once again, the website is www.streetpoetmontysmith.com. The book, Don't Shoot the Hostages, Poetry, Social Commentary for the New World Survivalists, $12 for the paperback, $5 for the ebook. You can also get that at www.streetpoetmontysmith.com.
Thank you so much, brother. And on behalf of the Your World News staff, producers, folks that helped me put together stuff and send me news feeds, I want to thank you for coming on this show. And I look forward to supporting you and continue to align myself with you. As I said before in that email, you know, we're brothers, and I look forward to developing a stronger bond with you. So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Once again, thank you for the support. Like I said, the more we can promote this type of talk, this type of conversation, the more we can counter what the mainstream is doing to the youth. So thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. And take care.
All right. We'll speak soon.
All right. For sure.
Peace.
The social systems influence the wisdom, hit them. The nation's politics inspired the apocalypse. Inner city living, synonymous to third world. This era predates Marvin, what's going on? Holiday songs, Lee Morgan on horns. The breakdown of the family structure gotta be strong. Keep moving on, change is constant. Langston painted pictures of the way the Renaissance went with words. He shared stories with such eloquence. Said it was a contradiction to be black and American. Phenomenal insight was shared during depression by intelligent scientists who walked the urban sections of this wilderness. Stilling us from then to now, looking back to move forward. From then to now, had the Panthers in the West, the nations on the East Coast. Malcolm and Martin both were sent back by the toast. Uprise, blaze of fires, the ghetto U.S. Only to destroy the economies of you and us. Wicked systems we trust for too long now. History repeats itself. See, we know more now. How to break the chain, how to change the game, how to heal your soul and ease the pain. I write expressions representing the extensions of a man. We're here to answer your questions and lend a helping hand. So lend your ear, cause we're here, my friends. The 1960s jazz revolution, again. Lend us an ear, cause we're here, my friends. The 1960s jazz revolution, again. Please lend the air, hear my friend, the 1960s jazz revolution, again.